What's up, everybody? This is Healing Intentions, and I'm your host, Dr. Adrian Mimetti. This podcast is about natural health and wellness, mental health, cannabis, psychedelics, philosophy, and spirituality. Today, my guest is Steve Farrar. Steve has been involved in specialty agriculture and organic food production systems for his entire professional life. He has been active in various aspects of mycology and mushroom production for over 35 years. His initial focus was on the production of specialty gourmet mushrooms for sale to restaurants and fresh produce markets. He has been involved in the planning, startup, and operation of several mushroom farms and has served as a consultant and mushroom equipment broker to mushroom farms all over the world. He has commercially produced many mushroom species as fresh produce items, including oyster, enoki, maitake, shiitake, king trumpet, and shimeji mushrooms. Starting in 2007, his focus turned to the production and processing of selected species of medicinal, nutraceutical mushrooms for use as functional food and dietary supplement ingredients. M2 Ingredients, Inc., the company he co-founded with Dr. Sandra Carter in 2010, is currently growing and processing 11 species of functional medicinal mushrooms in an indoor farm located in Carlsbad, California, utilizing a proprietary solid-state fermentation process that consistently produces high-quality mushroom powders. Development of this process and selection of the species and substrate for production involved multiple trips to Japan, Taiwan, and Europe, as well as consultation and cooperation with many mycological colleagues. M2 Ingredients provides the mushroom powders used in our retail brand lines, Om Mushroom Superfoods, Human, Equine Matrix, Horses, and Canine Matrix, and Pets. M2 Ingredients also provides organic mushroom powders as bulk wholesale ingredients to other formulators of dietary supplement and health food products. Let's get started. All right. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Healing Intentions. This is your host, Dr. Adrian Mimetti. And today I have a really special guest, Steve Farrar. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Yeah, I got a chance to meet Steve and his colleagues at the Psychedelia documentary that was screened at La Paloma Theater in Encinitas recently. The director of filmmaker Pat Murphy made this awesome documentary, and Om Mushrooms sponsored the event and actually handed us all, or not all, but some lucky recipients got some lion's mane capsules, which I was really grateful for. So really great. I'm meeting you guys all there.
Yeah, it was a great documentary. The guy did a really good job on it. And then afterwards, we had a panel of psychedelic therapists talking about their practice and their experiences with it, and discussing some of the fears we had as we moved towards decriminalization and the things that can go wrong and trying to avoid and do it the right way the first time.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. I thought it was really well done and can't wait to share that documentary when it comes out, you know, for bigger audiences, with all my friends and family and patients and whoever's interested enough to watch it. So it's very important to get the education out there. So, Steve, I want to just start with, if you don't mind, kind of your background. How did you get started with mycology? What's like your background story?
Well, it's kind of a convoluted tale, like a lot of background stories are. I'm a horticulturist by training, and I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and I did a bit of mushroom foraging. I was always interested in mushrooms and just another life form out there. I was kind of into plants at the time, and at least at the time when I was studying horticulture, the only place to study mushrooms or fungi at all is in plant pathology or forest pathology, you know, which is kind of a warped way of looking at mushrooms as potential pathogens of plants. So there definitely are fungal plant pathogens, but many of them are allies of plants. And so I just got interested primarily. I was always into organic agriculture and the effect of soil fungi and decomposers on soil tilth and fertility. Mm-hmm. And had the opportunity to work with a guy that was growing on a small scale And I just saw the potential of it, particularly in a rural area where I was at, where there's a lot of waste agricultural waste streams that potentially mushrooms could be grown, not only wood chips, but also corn straw and different wheat straw and different types of straw. So I developed a business plan and originally operated a farm in southern Utah. And then I got the opportunity to come here to Southern California and start up a farm, and did. So I originally was growing mushrooms, primarily exotic wood decaying species. I've never been interested in growing the common white button mushroom, which is grows on a composted, generally manure-based substrate. I was more interested in the wood decomposers. And so I focused on growing fresh mushrooms for the produce market and for restaurants. And I grew everything from oyster mushrooms to enoki to shiitake, maitake, king trumpet, shimeji mushrooms, and did that for a number of years, and then became more interested in the medicinal mushrooms. And by the time I'd been into growing these culinary mushrooms for years, kind of the market had kind of caught up with my kind of what I would say pioneering of kind of introducing some of these varieties that weren't used that well much either culinary wise in the United States or for other purposes, but it caught up. And so there was a lot of competition, and I thought, well, let's try growing medicinal mushrooms. And instead of worrying about keeping them fresh and keeping them refrigerated, let's process them into a powder and offer them as dietary supplement products. And kind of the focus was to make these medicinal mushrooms convenient to the American consumer that, for one thing, didn't really know about much of them, and that really, if it takes much effort, they're not probably not going to do it. So trying to incorporate into common foodstuffs and make it into a powder that they could add to their existing daily rituals, like into their coffee, into their smoothies, and promote it that way. So that's kind of how I got started in mushrooms. And mushrooms have a way of, once you kind of dip your foot in the water, they grab a hold of you, they infect you, and you never get out of the world of mushrooms. So many people have said the same thing. They kind of dabbled in mushrooms, and then pretty soon it took over their life.
Mm-hmm. The mycelium spreads as it finds a way to always do. It's awesome. Wow.
It does. Yeah.
Very, very cool. So when you came down to Southern California, is that when OHM started and all of that? How did that story begin?
Well, OHM didn't start until we formed the company in 2010. And I had a co-founder, a Dr. Sandra Carter. Mm-hmm. And that's when I kind of got out of the fresh produce industry and got into the medicinal mushrooms. And that was the precursor to that, was spending a lot of time traveling to Japan and Taiwan and also Europe, looking at different technologies of growing these mushrooms. Mm. and seeing what would work with the substrate we had available here in the United States and with the systems that we had. So I'd kind of developed a lot of the production methodology by the time I met Dr. Carter, and then we formed the company. And originally we had another brand name. We called it Mushroom Matrix, which I thought was a good name because we were always more into the whole food mushroom powders, the complete matrix of all the active ingredients, both nutritional and medicinal. And so that describing it as a matrix made a lot of sense. But then we got some marketing people in here, and they really liked the idea of calling it OHM, O-M for organic mushrooms. And we changed the brand name. And kind of our model is that we originally were producing the powders as bulk ingredients that we sold to other companies and incorporated into the variety of different products that they would develop and market. And we found that really we needed kind of more education about these things. And really the retail brands that we developed was an avenue of education and reaching out sales materials and a website, and also in-store demonstrations of how these mushrooms could be used in a variety of ways. Because we really wanted to get out of the idea of only using these mushrooms in capsules and only using them as immune supplements that were only bought in during the cold and flu season. We wanted to expand the possibilities of using and expand the whole marketplace for medicinal mushrooms. If it had really been a limited, and only a small section, not only in in the dietary supplement end of the stores and not at all in any other sections, any of the superfood sections or any of the other areas where mushrooms have some applications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I've really seen the medicinal mushrooms really explode here in the natural, you know, food and supplement products industries in the last few years, and rightfully so. I mean, there's so much benefit to it. I feel like we're just still scratching the surface of what we can, you know, find out about these mushrooms and how much they can really help. And that's on the legal medicinal side of the mushrooms. And then obviously this other paradigm shift happening now in the mental healthcare space with the psilocybin mushrooms and, you know, with psychedelic assisted therapy, that's a whole other ball game. And, you know, I feel like those two worlds are going to intersect here pretty shortly once the laws allow, because, you know, there's already so many people talking about, you know, stacking and how we can combine and the synergy between the way all of these mushrooms and other ingredients work. So it's really an exciting time. Really a great time to be alive in this world. I'm sure you've seen, you know, for over your career, how much it's changed. And especially now it's kind of hit this exponential growth curve. So it's going to be really exciting for you next few years.
Oh yeah. It was a struggle for years and years. And, you know, I'd say, you know, mushroom powders, people, if you get a wink and the poke in the ribs, you know, they all assume you're, you know, doing the right. Magic mushrooms.
Right.
And that's changed a lot. And then, you know, there's just so much ignorance, you know, mushroom powder, you know, people would say, ask the question, well, how you know, is it going to poison me? Like, you know, I'd be mm-hmm. producing a powder that would be poisoned. So, right. You know, the interest level has picked up. A big part of it was kind of came out of the gourmet cooking sort of movement where they're looking at other, you know, different foods to cook with, and mushrooms. There's all many species that had been ignored in the United States. So that kind of developed a lot of interest. Mm-hmm. And then once you get into the nutritional and culinary aspects of it, the health and the medicinal aspects of these mushrooms come to the forefront. And particularly in terms of this psychoactive psilocybin species, I see, you know, the interest in the standard medicinal mushrooms driving the interest in the magic mushrooms, because they see that the mushrooms are very powerful and that the mm-hmm. ones that can work in a mind are powerful. And then the ones that are already into the psilocybin mushrooms, they're seeing like the synergies and the where these mushrooms can be combined, and they all kind of help push in the right direction, not only in terms of just kind of cognitive and perception wise, but also in making your body strong and resilient so it can understand the rigors of some of these heroic doses that people are going through that are challenges. You don't go into lightly. You go only not only with mental preparation but with you know, keep having your body prepared as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very well said. That's the whole holistic perspective, you know, mind, body, spirit, it's all connected. So great that you look at it that way. So the big topic of debate in the mushroom world and the supplements world, mycelium versus fruiting body, is that even a debate in your mind? What can you say about that? I know that's a whole big topic, but what are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, it is a big topic, and it does take up a lot of space in the conversation, I'd say. Mm-hmm. And definitely there's some very completely opposite opinions on it. Some people are entirely in the mycelium camp, saying all the mojo, all the magic is in the mycelium, and that there's more bioactivity in the mushrooms. Mycelium, there's a greater level of gene expression and protein coding going on in the mycelium. And that, you know, that makes sense in a conceptual framework. It kind of makes sense because mycelium, it has to survive for extended periods of time in a very competitive environment. Doesn't have a big thick skin or bark to protect it. It's a very thin wall between it and its environment. Mm-hmm. It's got to protect itself against droves of parasites and competitors and pathogens. It's got to find and digest the substrate. So it's got a very active digestive system and a very active and robust immune system. The fruit bodies, on the other hand, you know, they're generally fairly short-lived, and all they have to do is as once enough energy has been gathered by the mycelium to come up and form a fruit body and release spores. And then very generally in most species, very quickly, the fruit body decomposes. And that's part of the dispersion strategy of getting spores out of some of my species. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it is the final stage of the mushroom life cycle. And it is, you can, that's something you can go out in the woods and pick a mushroom, whereas you can't go out in the woods and pick mycelium. Mm-hmm. It's embedded in the substrate. So most of our history of use of these mushrooms has been from fruit bodies, because that's what the ancient healers could do. They could go out in the woods and find a fruit body and pick it and then process it and cook it or extract it and use it medicinally or as food. Mm-hmm. It's really only with the advent of being able to autoclave and sterilize substrates and also work with sterile tissue culturing sort of techniques where you can grow the mycelium on edible substrates and actually grow and collect the mycelium. So the difference between the mycelium and the cells in the mycelium and the cells in the fruit body are not that much different. The mycelium becomes the fruit body. It's not like, say, the difference in a plant between the roots and the stem and the leaves and the seed and the flowers and the fruit of a plant. There's big differences between that.
Right.
It's not so extreme in mushrooms, although there are differences. So I think the people that say that it's all the fruit body is the only way to go, and that's where all the energy and nutrition and magic is at, and others that say the mycelium is where to go to, they both got it wrong. There's value in both. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do. We grow on an edible substrate as mycelial biomass. We grow on organic whole oats, which is a very good substrate for these mushrooms. It's a lot of nutrition to it. Mm-hmm. So the mushroom can grow much quicker than it can on a wood substrate with low nutrition that takes a long time to digest. Mm-hmm. The oats we do use the hull still on them, so it provides a bit of cellulose and lignin for these wood decaying mushrooms to first have to digest before it gets to the more nutritious kernel. And it also keeps the grains separate from mushing together, so I get and mix the inoculum in really evenly. And then once the inoculum is mixed in, there's a lot of passageways between the intact grains for oxygen to get to this rapidly growing mycelium for it to grow out. Now, a lot of people that are in the fruit body side of this controversy that are basically bad-mouthing the mycelial growers, what they'll do is they'll say, geez, when you grow a bag of mycelial biomass grown on grain, you're just buying undigested grain and you're basically buying flour. And what they'll do is they'll show a picture of a bag of spawn. Mm-hmm. Now, mushroom spawn is grain that has been autoclaved, inoculated with a tissue culture of the mushroom and allowed to grow maybe sometimes only 2 or 3 days, sometimes up to a week, just until the surface of each grain has been colonized. And so that individual grain can be serve as a point of inoculation when it's introduced into the bulk substrate, but it's not all bound together, so that's a chunk that you can't mix up into the substrate. So that is not what I produce here. Mm-hmm. We grow through periods up to 3 months the mycelium. It's not, and it's no longer useful as spawn. In fact, to get it into pieces once it's the growing process over, you have to run it through a high-powered stainless steel shredder to break up these blocks, because the mycelial blocks are they're like a block of wood almost. They're very mm-hmm. hard. They're hard to get apart. And with most of the species we grow, by that time the fruit bodies have formed. And really the fruit bodies are an indication that the mycelium has digested and utilized all the nutrition available in the substrate that's available to support further mycelial growth. And really the mushroom starts to switch gears to enter the final stage, the fruit body, to form the sexual spores. Mm-hmm. And so that's really an indication that it's no longer undigested grain there, but it's been converted into mushroom tissue and mushroom metabolites. Now, we do get a percentage of what we call myceliated grain in there. There's no direct way of measuring that. Mm-hmm. And if you did, it would be different for each species, but it's a very small amount. And actually there's Paul Stamets, my friendly somewhat of a competitor because we compete for shelf space, but I regard him more as a as an ally in terms of spreading the word about mushrooms.
Sure.
He's been able to show that the mycelial substrate portion of the final powder made from these mycelial biomass products actually has some immune functionality to itself on its own that is complementary and separate from that provided by the mushroom tissue itself. And then beyond that, in our system, we get something that neither the fruit body product users get, nor the mycelium users, because there's another way of growing mycelium, and that is in what they call submerged or liquid fermentation, where you grow the mycelium in a liquid format in giant fermentation tanks, generally a synthetic liquid nutrient cocktail, providing nutrients to the mycelium, and then you get it sterile, you aerate it, agitate it, and then you can get at the end you drain off the water and get the pure mycelium. Mm-hmm. Now that's a way of getting mycelium without any of the myceliated substrate that you would get if you grew it on a grain. But you also lose all the extracellular enzymes and secondary metabolites that the mushroom is putting into its environment. In a solid state fermentation system like I use growing on a grain, and like Paul Stamets does in his host defense products, you get all the extracellular components as well that arguably have as much bioactivity as the pure mushroom tissue and mushroom metabolite and the mycelial grain itself. So I've always been kind of a whole food guy. The idea of just taking a portion of the mushroom and trying to concentrate it and throwing away most of it to make an extract just never made sense to me. So we try to get the whole life cycle of the mushroom, the mycelium, the fruiting body, the extracellular compounds, the fermented substrate it's on, and present it in a whole food format. Rather than taking, say, milligram dosages of a concentrated extract, you take at least a couple grams a day of the whole food unextracted powder and get all of those active ingredients, albeit at lower amounts. But a lot of these compounds, you don't need massive amounts of these compounds. And in fact, massive amounts and concentrated amounts of isolated active ingredients could be really counterproductive in some instances.
Wow. Yeah, that's a very beneficial explanation. Thank you. And it kind of reminds me of with the whole cannabis world, you know, like CBD isolate, for example. You know, 99% pure isolate of CBD can be beneficial and it can be, you know, good for some people, but the full spectrum, like whole plant extract of cannabis to get the full spectrum of cannabinoids, even beyond just CBD, is way more beneficial. And so that makes a lot of sense to me, you know, to get all of the benefits out of it. Because, you know, like the example that's often used is, you know, lion's mane, we know that there's more beneficial compounds in the mycelium, for example. So if you're extracting from only the fruiting bodies, you're missing out on a lot of the benefit of what lion's mane has to offer. Do you know of any besides lion's mane that are beneficial compounds in the mycelium or that we'd be missing out on if we were only consuming the fruiting bodies, like lion's mane, for example?
Yeah. Well, the lion's mane definitely was a good example because there's one class of neurotrophic compounds called eicinones in the fruiting body and an entire another class of compounds that have neurotrophic functions called erinaceans in the mycelium. Mm-hmm. So if you're only getting the fruit body, you're missing out on a whole class of compounds that have cognitive function. Mm-hmm. I guess reishi is probably another one. The fruiting bodies are bitter and have higher concentrations of the triterpenine compounds to which most of the adaptogenic properties of reishi are attributed to, mm-hmm. where the mycelium has a greater diversity of polysaccharide compounds in it, beta-glucan compounds, and actually, they've done some work where they're looking at the activity of genes in the mycelium versus the fruiting body, and there definitely is more coding going on in the mycelial stage, more activity on the DNA and protein coding level in the mycelium versus the fruiting body. And another aspect of that is using reishi, the fruit bodies in food applications, say like, you know, you're putting in coffee or an energy bar in a smoothie or in a tea. Mm-hmm. The bitterness can be a problem with somebody, and particularly if it's an energy bar, it takes a lot of masking to mask that bitterness, so it's not to make it palatable.
Right.
So the combination of the bitter fruit body that we get in our culture with the mycelium, which is very sweet in taste, it kind of mellows out the taste, and you can use the whole food powder without having to use as much masking of the flavor, the bitterness flavor. Definitely the bitterness is there, but it's not as pronounced. I guess turkey tails may be another example. There's a couple of compounds that are used clinically that are patented out of Japan. Mm-hmm. PSP and PSK, they're mm-hmm. basically hot water extracts that contain polysaccharides, and they're primarily after the beta-glucan fractions. They preferentially use the mycelial stage of the turkey tail as opposed to the fruiting body, because they get it's a better source of the immunomodulating polysaccharides. Mm. Some of the species like Cordyceps sinensis, it's in artificial culture, it's just, we're not able to get the fruiting body right now. They can in some instances, but it's just not practical on a commercial scale. So really, there's some species of medicinal mushrooms we just don't even have access to the fruiting body stage. And Troidea camphorata is another one that I grow that we get the mycelium, but we're not growing on its native substrate, which is a camphor-like old forest, old growth rainforest tree that grows only in Taiwan. You really can't get the fruiting bodies, but it is the mycelium provides a lot of active ingredients, and it's one that's used in a lot of for liver health sort of conditions, and as well as for recovering from binge drinking alcohol sort of sessions, you know.
Yeah,
both as a pre-treatment to your binge drinking as a hangover treatment afterwards.
Love that. Yeah, nature has so much to provide us if we just know where to look. What do you have to say about the beta glucan? You mentioned that. I know some companies really like to make a point of their beta glucan content in their products. Is there big differences in the beta glucan and the alpha glucans versus, you know, in the fruiting body versus mycelium? Like, what do you say to that?
Yes. On a wet weight to wet weight, there is a larger percentage of beta glucans in the fruiting body than there is in the mycelium, but there's still quite a bit in the mycelium. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the measurement of beta glucans has really been a struggle for us, and also for other companies that are growing mycelial biomass products on a grain as myself. Mm-hmm. And the issue is that the existing methodology, they call it the Megazyme fungal beta glucan test kit, and it involves basically a series of enzymatic treatments of the sample before you actually then you do the analytical measurement of the beta glucan content. The existing method works well with a hot water extracted product where the beta glucans have been solubilized and extracted, and most of these other things that would, all the dietary fibers and other compounds that interfere with the quantification of the beta glucans mm-hmm. have been removed. In my whole food material, the existing method that only picks up a fraction, maybe a quarter of the beta glucans. So we've had to work with another lab there's actually a lab that had got kind of tired of the cannabis industry and decided to hang its hat on the mushroom industry, and he's doing a lot of good work. So we did a slight modification of the method to make the beta glucans in our whole food powders more quantifiable, and so we're getting beta glucan levels above 15%. Now, More beta-glucans aren't necessarily better. Beta-glucans, well, they have a number of functions. They're probably primarily known by their immunomodulating properties, which involves a host-mediated response whereby these beta-glucans get into your system and attach to receptor sites on different cells that make up our immune systems, things like natural killer cells and Dectin cells and T helper cells. And that attachment to receptor sites kind of tricks the immune cells into thinking they're being attacked. They're really not. It's a benign attack. It's not going to hurt them, but it kind of potentiates them and sets off a cascade of immune events, immune signaling events, cytokines and whatnot, that kind of tends to flex and prime the system. It doesn't take a whole lot of these beta-glucans to do that. They found that for most people, 100 milligrams can be quite sufficient. Maybe if you've got a raging infection or a advanced cancer sort of condition, you might want to go up to 500 or 1,000 milligrams. But in generally, relatively small amounts are enough to set off that host-mediated response. I would say that the dosage is not nearly as important as the frequency of dosing, because we're always getting the turnover of immune cells in our system. A lot of them are being discarded and then new ones are selling all the time. So you want to put all these new immune cells through their paces, I would say. And that potential, if you're just overloading your system with just, you know, grams and grams of pure beta glucans, it's potential in my mind, at least, to potentially make immunocompromised people that have autoimmune disorders, make that their conditions worse, and also just kind of flooding all these receptor sites so that there is actually a pathogen that immune cells need to pick up that they might not be picked up because it's all loaded up with beta glucans from mushrooms. So you want to take small amounts on a regular basis. And the interesting thing that I was just reading about how they get into a system. The beta glucans, when we digest them, they can go a number of pathways. Some of them, beta glucans, actually serve as dietary fiber. So they pass undigested into our lower digestion tract and serve as prebiotic dietary fibers that feed the beneficial probiotic organisms.
Right.
So that's one method how they work. They also tend to help absorb the dietary fiber aspects of them, help to absorb cholesterol so that we absorb less cholesterol from our food and our liver has less to process. They also have some antioxidant function to them. They can actually provide neutralized free radicals in our system. But primarily this immunomodulating happens via they get into our intestines and they're able to pass into our lymphatic system. See what are called these little pyre patches, these little portals throughout our intestines into our lymphatic system. And they're engulfed by macrophages. And what's fascinating to me there, these macrophages engulf these very large beta-glucan molecules that have very large molecular weights. And over the course of a week to 2 weeks, they cleave these large molecules into very progressively smaller particles that are then released. And those are the particles that then actually go on to attach to our receptor sites on the immune cells. Wow. So that's one of the reasons why mushroom beta glucans are tend to be, well, it depends on who you talk to. If you're talking to a yeast person, they all say, well, the yeast beta glucans are the ones that have been researched the most and are most effective. And that's what you should use for immune modulation. But the yeast beta glucan molecules tend to be more linear, less diversity and smaller molecules. And part of the value of the larger, higher molecular weight, more diverse compounds, beta-glucan compounds in the mushroom is the diversity of cleaved subparticles that come out from these large particles. But it's still, there's all sorts of opinions on the matter. And I would say that if you've got, say, stage 4 cancer and your digestion is shot, your appetite is bad, it might be hard for you to get down and digest a whole food powder. So in those sort of situations, I say that's where the more pharmaceutical preparations of the medicinal mushrooms make sense. You need to bring out the big guns in a concentrated drug-like format to try to get to a basically a rescue operation. But by and large, for health maintenance, I firmly believe that taking the whole food approach with these mushrooms and having the entourage effect of all the bioactive compounds, all the nutritional compounds, the minerals that are there, there's a lot going on in mushrooms. There really is.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Absolutely. Wow. So I noticed that with OM mushrooms, you're not doing any kind of extraction process, right? It's just the whole ground up mycelial biomass, and then that includes the fruiting bodies, and that's it, right? So do you miss out on any potential beneficial compounds that way, or have you just found that that's the best way to do it, and well, like, you know, versus hot water, alcohol extraction, all of that?
Yeah, you know, I think we do fine. You know, we do at the start of our process, one of the issues with doing a hot water extraction is you're making sure that you're dissolving and breaking up the chitinous cell walls of the mushroom that limit the uptake of the active ingredients that are inside the cells. So you need to disrupt and make the mushrooms more digestible. We do that by after we've grown them to maturity, and we've ground them up or shredded them in a stainless steel shredder. Mm-hmm. We go through at the first part of the dehydration process, we go through what we call a steam activation process, where we basically steam the mushrooms on stainless steel trays to basically cook them and make and soften the chitinous cell wall so it's bioavailable. And then once it's dried down to a very low moisture content, then we mill it to a very fine particle size, which further disrupts the cell walls and creates a lot of surface area on these powder particles for absorption and assimilation processes to work upon. And we get good uptake and good bioactivity out of it that way without having to go through the extraction, which a lot of times is defined as a way of making the active ingredients bioavailable, but that's not the only way to do it.
Yeah, that's interesting. It kind of reminds me of like with turmeric, curcuma longa. You know, if you just take the whole powder extract, it's not as well absorbed in the body. It's not as bioavailable. But then they've found in research that the curcuminoids, you know, the curcumin specifically is a lot more bioavailable. And sometimes I've seen companies put the whole, extract and pair it with like a fat, like a phosphatidyl choline or something like that, so that it's better absorbed in the body. And, thorn Mariva does that. So it's, better absorbed form of turmeric. So there's all kinds of different ways, and it sounds like you guys have figured it out. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Very cool.
And definitely, a lot of these mushrooms that really aren't that palatable otherwise, particularly things like the reishi and turkey tail and chaga that are really not culinary mushrooms, by growing them as mycelial biomass with fruit bodies, it's much more palatable to incorporate it into more different food things rather than just stuff it into a capsule and choking the capsule down.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So with an OM product, for example, like I saw in in the powders or even the capsules, let's say in the lion's mane, the one that we got at the screening, there's 2 grams in each serving. Is there any way to know like the split up there of how much of that's mycelial biomass, how much of that's fruiting body? There's no way to differentiate really, right?
No. And we do get the fruit bodies. We get quite a bit of fruit bodies. I'd say it's about on the fresh weight of the bags of the mycelial blocks, it makes up about 25% of the fresh weight of the block. So it's a significant amount there.
Okay.
And that 2 gram dosage, that's kind of across the board for all of the species that we grow. That's our health maintenance recommendation. And primarily that's based on providing enough beta glucans to provide that host-mediated immune response, because that's really bottom line. That's where people, particularly during this pandemic, with most people were seeking out mushrooms for the keeping their immune defenses up and up and running. So at 15, you know, and we're well above 15%, but even taking the baseline of saying 15% beta glucans, if you're taking 2 grams of that, that would provide basically 300 milligrams of beta glucans. And that's kind of in the sweet spot of between 100 and 500 milligrams, that kind of the range of opinions on what is required to elicit that immune response. Now, the other, you know, lion's mane, it does have the beta glucans and does help with immune response, but primarily people are going after lion's mane for its cognitive sort of benefits on nerve health, on memory, depression sort of aspects, and like you mentioned, for stacking protocols with psilocybin. It's kind of been by just experiments on ourselves and feedback from our customers of what is that dose that people experience something and feel an effect upon. And that seems to work with the lion's mane, is that the 2 grams is enough. Now, some people I've talked to said, hey, I take 2 grams and it's just too much. It's just, I'm my brain's just on fire. I can only take 1 gram a day. Mm. And sometimes they say it's some people that are really sensitive say a half a gram a day is almost too much for me. Mm. Other people I know are taking 6, 8, 10 grams a day. And these are primarily people that have had some nerve injuries or that are having some neurodegeneration sort of thing going on. The interesting thing, that the most common feedback I get from lion's mane is that people that rather than take it in the morning, they take it at night. They have really vivid dreams all night long, vivid technicolor dreams, and that's just a commonality. So it definitely affects your dream state, it was funny. We back when we were starting out, when we were growing lion's mane, we always noticed in the end of summer around August, we had an uptick in lion's mane sales, and a lot of times we couldn't even keep it on the shelf. We were trying to figure out what's going on. And we thought, aha, Burning Man Festival happens about the same time. And every year, that's the only thing I could attribute to is the increased interest in Burning Man usage of in the stacking protocols. But definitely the demand goes up during that time.
I was also thinking maybe back to school around that time for people, but
back to school as well. Yeah.
But Burning Man's another
another one. Yeah. And with lion's mane, sometimes the effects on cognitive function and memory and focus are really subtle. They come on slow, and so I'll have people say, I started taking lion's mane, I thought maybe it was doing something, I wasn't so sure, but then I ran out, and then in a couple of weeks I went back to my normal state of brain fog and lack of memory, and I said, yeah, this stuff was doing it. So they started using it again. So the effects can be subtle. Some people feel it the very first day after dosing. They say, and I'm feeling more alert, I feel more on my game. Other people, it takes a while. Other people say, I'm still not sure whether it did anything or not.
Just like with anything, we're all individual, our biochemistry, the way it interacts, and all the different factors, right? Our microbiome and all the other lifestyle factors and how our endocannabinoid system is doing and all that interplay. It makes sense. And really interesting timing. You mentioned about vivid dreams. I just got a book in the mail about lucid dreaming. So I'm excited to try that out. I've never even heard of that, have that effect from lion's mane. So I'm definitely going to add that to my nighttime protocol and I'll report back to you.
Yeah, let me know. And I think it's a dose dependent thing too. Depending on the amount of dose, it's related to the intensity of the dream experience. The people have said,
awesome.
And some people enjoyed the experience. Other people didn't. They said, God, I had horrible nightmares. Which I think that's kind of a learning situation as well. Your nightmares, but not everybody wants a vivid nightmare during the night, I guess.
Well, and it's interesting too, the same thing people report from taking melatonin. Sometimes they can feel, they can get great sleep and nothing happens. And sometimes people report having horrible nightmares from melatonin. And funny enough, biochemically, melatonin is just a couple steps away from DMT.
Yeah.
And so that makes a whole lot of sense to me. So what are you most excited about in this medicinal mushrooms kind of space? You know, what really gets you excited kind of thinking forward here in the future?
Well, definitely the decriminalization of psilocybin mushrooms and bringing that into accessible to people that need it to me is really exciting. You know, I'm not delving that area. It's still a Schedule I drug, and I don't want to go through all the licensing and DEA stuff to do that. So I'm going to leave that to the other people. But I definitely want to supply other mushrooms that can be have an entourage effect that way. And on the one hand, I see new mushroom companies starting up all over the country. I see a new mushroom company almost a day, every day on Facebook and on the social media. And in a way, you know, I see these guys as competitors of what I'm doing, but it really encourages me that more people are catching on, and there's room for a lot more mushroom growers in the United States than there are right now. Our per capita consumption of not only culinary mushrooms but medicinal mushrooms, it's way lower than the Asian countries that have been hip to this for centuries. So there's a lot of room for it to grow, and there's a lot of room for everybody to make more people to make a living in mushrooms. And so I'm encouraged that it's becoming mainstream, and that more young people are taking up the cause and getting really, really excited about it. Cause I'm ready. I'm kind of at retirement age. I'm ready to pass the baton on to somebody else, but I want to make sure that, you know, it doesn't get dropped, and it's not going to get dropped. There's a lot of people that are, and the technologies now that we have to deal with some of these things, like the positive ID of species and finding new species with DNA technologies, our analytical capabilities. Although, you know, I have a deep distrust of analytical lab reports of bioactive compounds in mushrooms. I really do, because I've tried to test for a lot of the active ingredients in these compounds, and sending the samples to different labs, the same sample to different labs, I get results all over the range. So you can pick the lab basically to get the results you want almost. And I think that's what a lot of these companies are doing. And part of it is that the analytical techniques are not really well developed.
Right.
Here in the United States, there's not a whole lot of demand for these tests, so that if a lab does it, it's not like he's doing it on a regular basis and the lab technician can kind of dial it in and knows the process. It's like it's going back to the book and saying, you know, reviewing the steps and trying to get it right every time. And a lot of these are really fairly complicated procedures that take multiple stages of digestion, and you got to get the dilutions right and the calibration right. Mm-hmm. And even a lot of these compounds here in the States that companies said, well, I would do it for you, but I can't get a reference standard of the compound to calibrate your equipment with. Mm-hmm. The Chinese are light years away ahead of us. The government sponsors the mushroom industry. They have regular mycology courses in the universities. You don't have to go to plant pathology to study it as an afterthought in an agricultural school. They support the industry. They subsidize really the export of mushroom products. So the Chinese are a lot ahead of us a lot on some of that aspects of mushroom growing. And the one thing that they don't do very well though is protecting their environment. Mm. And so, you know, with them, so much heavy metal pollution and pesticide pollution there. I think buying anything, particularly a mushroom product out of China, you're just rolling the dice. And I know there's a lot of people that their business model is buying medicinal mushroom products in bulk out of China and repackaging it, selling them here. And they always go on about, oh, we grow them in a pristine area of China and it's totally clean and these guys know what they're doing. I don't believe it. I really don't, you know. Mm-hmm. Here I'm in California. You can come and visit me with no notice and I'll show you what I do. The FDA came and camped out on our doorstep and spent 4 days here and found nothing that we're doing wrong. You try to inspect the place in China, you got to give them advance warning and you have to be accompanied by a government employee. So they got plenty of time to clean up their stuff and show you what they want, and then go back to doing what they were doing when you're gone. So I really advocate buying your mushrooms, product of USA if you can. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot of companies out there, and they don't make a big deal about it. They try to kind of put under the covers that they're buying from China. And it is becoming more wide known that mushrooms can bioaccumulate both healthy, good things, but also they bioaccumulate heavy metals, pesticide residues, even radiation. They can bioaccumulate.
Mm. Very similar to the hemp, to the cannabis plant, how it can bioaccumulate, you know, the good and the bad things. That's fascinating. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, you're right here locally. I'm in San Diego. You're just right up the road in Carlsbad. So I might come and visit you here soon and check it out. If you don't mind, that'd be awesome to check out the facility.
Yeah. And we're in practice of expanding our facility and really upgrading a lot of the processes so that they're more flow through, continuous flow sort of as opposed to batch processes. And so, looking to keep up and really a lot of, we sell a lot of powders to other companies. So if you're seeing a product out there in the marketplace that's got mushroom powders in it, chances are it's something that we grew here, right here in Carlsbad, and it's sold into as a bulk ingredient.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's really cool. Another question that I have for you, going back to the whole, psychedelic renaissance that's happening. You lived through that whole time in the 60s and 70s, you know, and kind of how they got a lot of things wrong. What would you say are some lessons that we can learn from that to not repeat those same mistakes, doing it this time around?
Well, somehow we have to present these psychoactive mushroom species as being a very serious matter, and that they're not party drugs.
Right.
And I try to do that because, you know, on the one hand, we've got the kind of the microdosing sort of crowd that are taking it, you know, I think a lot of them are abusing it. They're taking microdosing almost on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you need some time to recover from it, and you just don't do it every day.
Right.
And in a microdosing, you know, at just a small dose, you can function, you know, you have some heightened senses and mental processes, and it's, you mm-hmm. can function in a, around people in a social sort of setting. But I don't know how to separate that aspect of it versus the more heroic doses in clinical or in ritualistic sort of settings. And
that, right.
We kind of need to separate those two sort of uses together and not have people going out to a rave and being, you know, taking a heroic dose and just, you know, doing something, you know, dangerous and hurting themselves or other people, so that we get it becomes demonized again, that, you know, our people are, you know, the whole line that, you know, people are taking magic mushrooms and jumping, thinking they can fly and jumping off buildings, something like that. We don't want to go down that path.
Right.
The reefer madness sort of deal, that people need to know that these are serious, powerful medicines that you need preparation, intent, prepare not only your mind, but also your body for intense experiences, and that use them responsibly and with caution. So I don't know quite how we get around that, but it's a sticky issue. And there's a lot of people using mushroom because it's not, you know, a particularly hard mushroom to grow. There's people all around growing it on a hobby basis, you know, in their right. closet or on their countertop. And I think it'd be surprised how much psilocybin is consumed on a daily basis in any given area, and how much is being produced in an underground level. So we'll see how this all pans out, because it's just like with cannabis. There was, you know, definitely an underground, and people were growing it in their closets and in their garden and whatnot before it became legal. So once it became legal, both medical and recreation wise, that continued. So it's a tricky thing. And then particularly that panel, I thought that after the screening of the documentary, the panel discussions of people that have described their experiences with them and their fears, I thought that was really well done.
Absolutely. I am just fascinated how entrepreneurs here in California are not waiting for the laws. it's not even decriminalized yet. It just talks about it. And I've already, since moving to San Diego a year and a half ago, I've met 10 different people making psilocybin mushroom chocolate bars.
Yeah.
And they're thriving. Yeah. It's really amazing. And, you know, it's just the beginning. It's like, if I personally met 10, imagine how many more are out there, you know? And so it's pretty exciting. I heard also that up in Canada, there's actually like shops you can go into and buy mushrooms, just like, you know, in Amsterdam, and they're not legal, but they're operating and they're not being shut down. So
yeah. They're just the regular and enforcement. They're just looking the other way. It's like of low regulatory importance. They're just looking the other way because they see, you know, in terms of a risk mitigation, there's people aren't going crazy. They're not people getting hurt. It's doing some good. So,
yep.
You know, they're kind of taking that approach to it.
Yep. Which makes sense. You know.
Yeah. You know, in my sense is that with these mushrooms, you know, it doesn't take much of the mushroom to even heroic doses, not that much mushroom material. My sense is that there's not, the money really isn't in the growing of these psilocybin mushrooms. It's the more in the processing into a format, say into the chocolates or a gummy, or even, you know, some people nasal sprays and whatnot, is going to be where there's more money, and even more money in the therapeutic aspects of it, of guiding the experience, and either, you know, from a shamanistic sort of guided sort of more naturalistic setting, or in the clinical settings with licensed therapists. So I'm not quite sure how that's going to shape out, but you could definitely flood the market with psilocybin mushrooms if anybody went to it on a commercial scale, like I'm growing the lion's mane right now. I could flood the market with magic mushrooms. You know, more than I could give everybody in the county a dose here in pretty short order, which I'd love to do, but I don't care.
That would be how we repeat the 60s and 70s saying everybody should get LSD in the water.
Yeah. Tune in, turn on, drop out. All that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I don't think they had such a bad idea. Just they got a little too far. And so trying to learn those lessons here and do it the right way. And I think in a nutshell, what it comes down to is education for people, knowing what's what, how to do it properly, you know, harm reduction, not prohibition. Prohibition doesn't work, as we've seen, but educating people on, okay, you're going to use these different plant medicines. Here's how you do it. Here's how you do it safely with the right intention, the integration afterwards. That's really the whole name of the game and getting, you know, the most therapeutic benefit out of it. So yeah. What else do you want to share with the audience here, Steve? It's been a great discussion. I know we could talk for a long time on these topics, but I don't want to keep you too long. What else is on your mind about either medicinal mushrooms or OM or just anything?
You know, a lot of times we get questions on, you know, people come up and say, I've got this condition. What mushroom should I take for it? That's really hard for me because, one, I'm a mushroom grower. I'm not a doctor, and also, you know, by definition, as a dietary supplement, you can't say that treats are used to treat or mitigate any disease, so we kind of got our hands tied that way. There is, you know, people can go and do their own searches and find online a lot of information about the individual medicinal aspects of these mushrooms. And really the activities of them kind of blend. You like all the mushrooms have beta glucans in them, and they all have immune functionality to them. It does, but that being said, each different species of mushroom has different molecular structures for their beta glucan compounds, different sizes of the beta glucan compounds, different solubilities, different side chain attachments. So that one idea is that by combining several species of mushrooms together, you get a diversity of beta glucan compounds that have a potential for eliciting a more robust immune response. And mycologist Paul Stamets did do some studies where he did look at that, and in cell line studies, they were able to show that a blend of mushrooms activated more immune responses in cells than a single species did at the same dosage. So that there is that, and it, you know, it makes it, you know, conceptually it makes a lot of sense. A lot of, although a lot of people think that, well, I'm going to get a blend of 10 mushrooms in it, and it's got lion's mane in it, so I'm going to get all the cognitive benefits from it. So we do have a, what we call a master blend. It's got 10 species in it, two grams of the blend of mushrooms in it, but the lion's mane only makes up 10% of that. So you're only getting 200 milligrams of that. Mm-hmm. That's probably not enough of a dose to elicit in the cognitive effects of the mushroom, but the combined beta glucans from all the 10 species with the commonalities between them are going to help with immune functionality, help with antioxidant support, help with gut health in terms of the prebiotic dietary fibers that are there, mm-hmm. and help on some other levels. So people have to modulate their, you know, their expectations. And if you are really interested in the cognitive function of mushrooms, of go to those mushrooms that have those properties to them. A lot of times we combine lion's mane with reishi, because reishi does have, it's been shown to have some cognitive aspects to it. Plus it helps with stress. And if you're stressed, even if your brain is working well, it's compromised by the stress. So if you can not only enhance brain function, but be calmer and more centered, that's going to contribute by a different mode of action. Kind of, again, the entourage effect of several things with different modes of action, action pointing in the right direction, or gently pushing you in that right direction, not slamming you there, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. That just got my mind spinning on, you know, you said the entourage effect a few times, and that's the same phrase that's used in the cannabinoid side of things with, you know, CBD isolate versus the full spectrum and how they all work together. And I get really excited about combinations of all of these things, you know, cannabinoids and mushrooms and other nutrients and other botanicals, and putting it all together into some cool products. You know, that's the kind of stuff that gets me excited, and will be plenty of, there's already stuff out there like that and lots more to come.
Yeah. One of the things I like to see, there's apparently some people were working on comparing the effects of taking laboratory made psilocybin, which is basically, you know, synthetic pure psilocybin, versus taking a psilocybin mushroom, because there's mm-hmm. lots of other compounds, just the psilocybin and the psilocin. Mm-hmm. And there's I believe there's an entourage effect of in the, taking a whole magic mushroom as opposed to a synthetic compound. So I'd like to see that kind of teased apart and see what the differences are.
Yeah, definitely. Me too, because I've also seen, just like in cannabis, there's all the different cultivars, the different strains, and, you know, the effects and how they make you feel. Same thing in the psilocybin mushrooms. There's all different types of strains of Golden Teacher and Cambodian, yeah, and Brazilian, and on and on and on. And they are slightly different. So what's going on in the chemistry there? It's going to be fascinating to really dive into that.
It is. Yeah. It's, and you can kind of, you know, by picking a different strain or a different species, you can, you know, definitely kind of affect your experience and tailor that to whatever your purpose, what your intent was going in there. Mm-hmm. I think.
Definitely. Well, awesome, Steve. This has been a really great conversation. I appreciate, again, you taking the time, and look forward to, you know, hopefully coming up and visiting the facility here soon and talking more.
All right. Well, I love talking mushrooms. So anytime, you know, I'm up.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Steve. We'll talk soon. Have a great one.
All right. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.